In the consolidated cases of McLean versus Board of Review and Blake versus Board of Review, may we please have appearances?
Good morning, Justices. Melissa Dutton Schaefer, Assistant Attorney General, on behalf of the Board of Review.
Good morning, distinguished Justices. My name is Alan Lesso, and I'm representing the argument on behalf of Petitioner Cynthia Blake and Respondent Patricia McLean.
May it please the Court, distinguished Justices, Kenneth Goldman, South Jersey Legal Services, for the petitioner Cynthia Blake and the respondent Patricia McLean.
Good morning, distinguished Justices. Alan H. Shore on behalf of Amicus, Neil in New Jersey.
Welcome, counsel. Justice LaVecchia, again, will be participating in both of these cases and we'll watch the video. Ms. Schaefer.
May it please the Court, before I begin, I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. We're here today to construe a provision of the unemployment compensation law that provides a narrow exception to otherwise disqualifying circumstances. Ordinarily, a claimant that leaves one job for another, absent good cause, is always disqualified from receiving benefits because his unemployment was a result of his own actions. That claimant can only re-qualify for benefits down the road if he obtains subsequent employment, works at least 8 weeks, and earns a certain amount of money, unless he satisfies the conditions of the exception. If he satisfies the exception, he is relieved of those re-qualifying obligations, meaning he need not work for the 8 weeks and earn 10 times his weekly rate. In order to fall within the exception, 4 things have to happen. First, a claimant must voluntarily leave his job. Next, he must leave the job for the purpose of taking another job. Third, the subsequent job must be for at least the same pay or hours as the first. And finally, the claimant must actually start the subsequent job within 7 days of leaving the first. This reading is evident through the plain language of the statute, it's consistent with the statutory scheme as a whole, and is strongly reinforced by the legislative history. It also harmonizes the UCL's remedial nature with the need to ensure that only those who are entitled to benefits receive them. Beginning with the plain language of the statute, the generally accepted meanings and definitions of the relevant terms in the sentence support the board's interpretation. The term employment generally means the condition of having paid work. The statute defines it as, among other things, services performed for money. And then the term commence generally means to start or begin. Thus read together, employment which commences plainly means to start or begin paid work. The only way to accept employment which commences is to thus start working. Acceptance of a mere offer of employment that will commence sometime in the future does not equate to actually starting work. This is why reliance on the phrase to accept is short-sighted. It fails to think through exactly what is being accepted, which is actual work. Also instructive is the condition requiring that the subsequent job have at least equal hours or pay to the first. This requirement necessarily presumes that a claimant has actually worked and earned wages. This reading makes complete sense when you look at the statutory scheme as a whole. Remember, the unemployment law is intended to provide assistance to those who lose their jobs through no fault of their own. Thus, the amendment must be read to benefit those who leave a job, secure another job within 7 days, and are subsequently laid off before being re-qualified. Not those that leave a job and never commence a second one for whatever reason. Under the scheme of the statute, any benefits paid must relate to the unemployment resulting from a non-voluntary event, a layoff, a termination, or some other type of good cause. You cannot receive benefits under the statute if you simply leave your employment. Therefore, under this exception, the benefits are paid to relieve the claimant from a layoff by the subsequent employer, not from his own voluntary decision to leave his job. For all of these reasons, the court need not look beyond the language of the statute itself. However, should the court find that the language is ambiguous, the legislative history is equally compelling here. Every legislative statement accompanying the Senate and Assembly bills, as well as the transcript of the June 5, 2014 Senate Labor Committee hearing, supports the board's interpretation. The legislative statements all include language showing that the bill was meant to relieve certain disqualified claimants of the ordinary requalifying obligations, but only if they are laid off from the subsequent job. The legislative impact statement further supports this reading because it contains language referencing data on the number of claimants who left work voluntarily without good cause in 2013, but also states it had no data on the number of those who, quote, secured future employment and then were subsequently laid off by the new employment. Finally, the transcript from the Senate Labor Committee hearing eliminates any doubt that the amendment was intended to require the claimant to actually commence employment within 7 days.
But you say that there's no doubt, yet we have two appellate division cases that go in different directions. So there is some doubt on the parts of some of the judges as to how this case should have come out. And you keep focusing on the statutory language, which talks about to accept employment, which is exactly what happened in both cases. And yet those offers were then rescinded by the employer through no fault of the employee. Is that fair to punish her for accepting a new job, which the legislature has indicated is a firm and an appropriate thing for somebody to do? They encourage people to go and look for new jobs. That's what they did, and they were offered jobs. They accepted these new jobs, and then through no fault of their own, they were rescinded.
So I think what will help answer that question is reframing this. You had used the word punish these types of claimants, and I think what is at issue here and what the McLean court was missing in rendering its decision is that this provision is an exception to an otherwise disqualifying event. So to be entitled to benefits, two things have to happen. A claimant has to be eligible for benefits, and then they also have to not be disqualified. Ordinarily, leaving your job voluntarily, including to accept another job, would be a disqualifying event. Here, the legislature determined that for those who have secured employment and started that job within 7 days, they should not be required to then stay at that job for the 8 weeks and earn those ten times amount, their weekly rate. So they're relieving these specific types of claimants from those requalifying standards. So it's not a situation where they're being punished. Excuse me, Justice.
If they started the job and worked 1 day, would they be qualified?
Yes.
So 1 day would fit the exception under your interpretation, but not that the employer didn't rescind the job offer?
Correct.
What if they showed up and never worked? Showed up and the new employer said, nobody called you? This is off.
No. Then I think that would be that they had not commenced the job, they had not started the job. If they showed up and said, sorry, there was a misunderstanding, we no longer have the job.
So if they go in and they go get as far as sharpening their pencils or whatever people do on their first day of a new job and filling out forms, they're in, but they're out if, as they walk in the door, the employer says, I guess there's some confusion, my assistant was supposed to call you or whatever it is that they're blaming on.
Yes, that's the line that the legislature drew.
And why would that make any policy sense?
It makes policy sense because, again, the purpose of the statute is to provide benefits to those who lose their job through no fault of their own, those that are laid off, terminated, or have good cause. So again, the benefits here attach to the action that occurs at the subsequent employer. It is not to relieve someone from quitting their job because they think that they have another job. Certainly,
why is the verb, if you read the language of this, it says to accept from another employer employment, which commences not more than 7 days after the individual leaves employment with the first employer, and then the next clause that you referred to. The key language is an individual voluntarily leaves work with one employer to accept from another employer, etc. Isn't the key act here the departure and the purpose of the departure?
It is. The purpose of the departure, though, you can't simply end at the word employment. But even if you did end at the word employment, employment still contemplates the beginning of work.
But let's focus on that.
If that was what it said, begin employment. They said acceptance. Do you see a difference there? The legislature knows how to write. Okay, so they meant for the person to actually start. Wouldn't they have said begin employment rather than accept employment?
Well, they said commence. So rather than choosing the word begin, they chose to say employment which commences.
But they didn't say which actually commences. Are you adding that word where it doesn't exist in the statute?
I'm adding it for purposes of argument here, but the word actually would not need to be read into it.
So doesn't that create the ambiguity? There's you are claiming that your adversary is adding in the word actually, and they're claiming that you're taking that you're trying to take out the words to accept. Like the legislature could have, I'm looking at the statute now, and I'm going to read it.
Yes,
the way you want us to read it.
Okay.
This subsection shall not apply to an individual who voluntarily leaves work with one employer and commences employment with another employer not more than 7 days. They could have written it that way. They could have written it without the word to accept to advance the very point that you are now espousing, right?
They could have.
But they didn't. So doesn't that, between the divergent interpretations of the statute, you're claiming that they're putting in the word actually. They're claiming that you're reading out the words to accept. Don't we at least have an ambiguity in this statute?
I don't think we necessarily have an ambiguity, and here's why. If you read the phrase together as a whole, to accept from another employer employment which commences, you have to read all of those terms together.
But we don't need the word to accept. That's why I read to you a version without, and this is the point that Justice Fernandez-Vina was saying. They could have written the statute easily just to say when you begin employment without using the words to accept.
They could have, but in accepting the board's interpretation, it doesn't write out the term to accept. It doesn't negate the term to accept. It simply finds a way to harmonize those words all together, and then also looking at the larger structure of the statute. So to only put emphasis on the phrase to accept, it negates the need to secure and start that subsequent employment such that you're then laid off.
So then you want us to read the statute in a way that my colleagues have illustrated will lead to absolutely absurd results. Through no fault of his or her own, the employee leaves the first employment, is expecting to start employment within 7 days, and then within 1 day before beginning work, it's rescinded. Under your construction, no benefits. If they start the second job, and as Justice Patterson said, start sharpening the pencils, then full benefits. You think that is a logical construction of a statute that is considered socially remedial legislation?
I do. And I do because, again, we're looking at what is otherwise disqualifying conduct. So if you leave your job, before this exception, before 2015, anyone that left their job for another job would be disqualified for benefits. Anyone. So if you left your job and you secured another job and then were laid off, you could only requalify for benefits if you had worked at that subsequent job for 8 weeks and earned 10 times your weekly rate. That's the only way you could ever qualify for benefits, even if it was leaving work to get another job. So none of these folks would ever have qualified until this exception.
No question that the 2015 amendment mm-hmm. very significantly allowed broader benefits to perhaps a large number of individuals. I think our question here is more precise than that, and that is in the really peculiar circumstances that existed in both of these cases, which I'm just venturing a guess is not a huge number of people. Did the legislature intend to exclude those people? And what's concerning me is I don't see. We know what the policy is. The policy is we want to encourage people to try to better their condition, make better money, work more hours, get a job that's going to make them more financially independent. And we don't want people to hold back because they're worried about their unemployment benefits and that gap, which could be devastating to somebody. Why would it make sense to knock out the person who does all that, leaves their job for that very reason, is told, I don't think there's any question that these two individuals were told, here's your job, here's your hourly, here are the hours you're going to work, it meets the qualifications there, and yet before they get there, they're told all bets are off,
right,
and they have nothing to do with that. Why would the legislature cut that subset of claimants out?
So again, it's not necessarily cutting them out, but they certainly would not fall within the limited scope of folks that the legislature intended to protect.
And what would make sense about that?
So it makes sense for a couple reasons. One, again, the general purpose of the legislation is to only provide benefits to those who are laid off, subsequently laid off. When the employment never commences, they're not laid off. Secondly, it's consistent with sort of this. You need to balance the remedial nature of the legislation with also ensuring that the fund is protected and that people are not getting benefits that shouldn't. And one way of doing that is to draw a definitive line by this reemployment. And that's supported extensively by the hearing transcript at the Senate Labor Committee hearing on June 5th.
But even on that, if I may, even if you assume that the thing on the minds of the senators was a potential for a layoff on the first day or week, why does that exclude the really unusual situations we're talking about here? I mean, if senators say we're doing X, this is what the statute's about, we're concerned about X,
mm-hmm.
does that mean that they exclude everything that they don't mention in a hearing as we look at legislative history?
It doesn't, but so there was actual discussion about the fact that whether or not these folks had to be reemployed. The sponsor of the legislation, Senator Madden, expresses multiple times this concept of being reemployed right away, ASAP. Even the amicus who was present at that hearing acknowledges that the reading of the statute, the reading of the bill at that time, would have contemplated the need to have someone start that employment.
That just tells us that they limited it to 7 days, not 14 days, not 21, that the gap could only be 7 days. But if the gap is just 7 days with respect to the acceptance,
yes, within the context
we still
of the
we still have that limitation. Yes?
Yes.
Isn't that borne out by Justice Alvin's argument? Isn't that borne out by part of the statute? If you get 30 days notice and your employer terminates you now, you're not starting at 7 days from the 30 days notice. You've been terminated long before that, and you still fall under the exception. So
yes, the exception protects.
It's not 7 days, because in that situation, if you're expecting 30 days notice, or you start 37 days later, and they terminate you today, you give them notice. You're actually starting 37 days after, but you're still covered under the exemption.
Yes, because there's specific language in there that covers that person from the date that they gave their notice, the resignation date.
Shouldn't our interpretation of commences determine on whose actions it was, whether it was the employee who chose not to start at 7 days or the employer terminated for whatever reason, and there's no fault, no voluntary act from the employee? Shouldn't we focus on that?
Right. Well, there was some
discussion.
And if we
do that, then you don't have to start at 7 days if the employer terminates the employment offer, the new employer.
So the 7 days, so I think what you're asking is, yes, the concern was if your employer terminates you prior to your expected resignation date, the legislature wanted to ensure that that person would not, that the claimant would not be penalized for that.
In that situation, the focus on the employer's actions, correct?
The first employer's, yes.
Right. Why shouldn't the second part depend on the second employer's actions also, rather than the employee's involuntary action that, oh, suddenly there's a job offer at 7 days, now it's rescinded? Why shouldn't that part focus also on the employer's actions like the first one does?
Well, there was no discussion of that at the Senate hearing, but the reason that the reemployment requirement makes sense is that you have to have some definitive action that the board can look at, some verifiable evidence that there was employment, subsequent employment. So if you simply have an offer for employment, that leaves so many questions as to how to prove that. Some offers are made in writing,
verbally. How difficult is that? You have a letter making an offer, and you have a letter of acceptance, or you can have that verbally. And the burden is going to be upon the worker anyway to prove it. How does that put you in a difficult position?
So a worker would then, you would have potentially inconsistent results if you have a worker who, if the burden is on that claimant, and you have someone who has a letter, an offer letter to show, as well as a rescission, and they have documented proof of that. Maybe that person could show it. But then over here, the person that got a verbal offer and a verbal rescission has nothing.
But so the board your response would find that they haven't met their burden. The fairness in your response is, in order to protect the people who can actually prove it, we'll give it to no one.
No, it's too...
That's fast. I understand your argument.
Not at all. It's that the legislature had to choose an action that was going to be 100% consistent and verifiable. And the consistent and verifiable act is the reemployment. And again, that is consistent with needing to have, you don't get benefits for simply quitting your job and then having no subsequent employment. You get benefits.
No question at all.
If you
that.
Leave your job and then you're reemployed and then you're laid off. And in that situation, you can only requalify for those 8 weeks.
Let me ask you, just what we were talking about process over here, talking about proof. Couldn't the board simply subpoena the employer and say, Mr. Smith, Mr. So-and-so says that you gave him a job offer and you rescinded it. Is that true or not?
The employer would have that subsequent employer would have absolutely no interest or, you know, sometimes an employer may agree to do that.
Wouldn't you be in these hearings, don't you have the ability to subpoena witnesses?
There wouldn't be a hearing here because the fact that when a claimant would apply for benefits under this scenario, the only way you would get to an appeal tribunal hearing is if that payment of benefits is appealed in some way. That would not occur here because neither employer would be implicated.
Does the board have the ability, as a practical matter, maybe the answer is no, to make a call or do something to verify whether the claimant is making a statement of fact? I would think that in many contexts the board has questions regarding the veracity of some representation made by a claimant. So is there an ability to do any fact-finding?
They do have the ability to do fact-finding. I mean, certainly there's a hearing, and they can request that witnesses are there.
Could the board make a call or find out? I know that often employers are very recalcitrant about anything other than start date, end date, but would the board have the ability to somehow, either with legal process or with phone call or whatever, verify whether someone was actually given an offer and had that rescinded?
Again, they could attempt to do that. Whether or not they would be able to receive that information is unclear.
I guess if the claimant makes that request and doesn't get that information from the alleged subsequent employer, they lose.
They would not be able to meet their burden.
Okay. So they would have an opportunity. That there would be evidence that could be presented, just that the burden, as Justice Albin suggested, would be on the claimant. If the claimant has no evidence they had another job to go to, they lose. The fund wouldn't be affected. Nothing would change.
That claimant would still be in the same situation that the justices are concerned with now.
Exactly.
Which is that
exactly.
It's they follow their own, and they didn't have a written offer, and so...
Exactly. You're right. They might lose. They don't have the evidence of subsequent employment unless at some kind of evidentiary proceeding the decision is, well, they've established it by doing A, B, C, and D, but you're right. They would lose. There might be concern, but that's not what we're talking about.
But that's all the more reason why the reemployment is required here. And it also ensures that there's not going to be benefits paid either through fraudulent reasons or reemployment creates
that. That's why God built courthouses, right? So we can make sure that doesn't happen, right?
Can I ask you about a different part of the statute?
Of course.
You've argued that the exception clause at the end doesn't make sense, is irrelevant if there's not an actual start date. Can you explain that, and then I have a question about it.
I'm sorry.
In your brief, you argue that the language at the very end of Section A, that clause, the exception, is irrelevant if you don't have an actual start date. Tell us what your position is, and then I wanted to ask you about it.
So that was what the Blake court relied on, that language, to say that exception language about if you're terminated early. And we had accepted that in our brief. Upon further thought on how that clause would play out.
You're no longer there.
I'm no longer there.
I think that's a wise move. I won't ask my follow-up.
Okay.
but let me ask you this instead. Amicus argues that under the facts here, the first employer's account is not going to be charged based on the rescission by the second employer. Do you agree or disagree with that?
I agree with that.
Tell us why.
I agree with that because the first employer's account is only charged when the termination occurs in some way connected to that first employer. So if the employer terminates, lays the person off, or the person has good cause to leave that's attributable to that work.
So does that undermine the Blake decision?
Absolutely not. Because, again, that was dicta. The Blake court did talk about this concern about the first employer having to carry some burden and then bear the financial consequences if the benefits are paid. So the Blake court, was mistaken. However, that does not undermine the ultimate holding there. Because looking at the way that the employers are charged here, I think also informs why this reemployment requirement is necessary. So in these situations, anytime someone leaves their job voluntarily to accept other employment, the first employer is never charged because it's through no fault of the employer.
Who would be charged in a situation such as that?
No one. So, ordinarily, if they requalify, if they're reemployed and they...
Forget about requalify. In a situation such as this.
Under this exception?
Under the McLean ruling, who would be charged?
So, under McLean's interpretation, where all you need is an offer, if that were to be paid out, no one would be charged. No one's account. Neither the first employer, and because there's no second employer, the second employer's account is not charged.
It would come out of a trust fund?
So everything comes out of the same fund. It's just a matter of how that fund is replenished. Ordinarily, claims that are paid out are charged back to the responsible employer or employers. And so that impacts their tax rates moving forward, and their tax rates are increased to cover the benefits paid out. Under this exception, though, whether you accept the Blake reading or the McLean reading, no one is charged.
The same is true if a person is terminated after one day of employment with the new employer, correct? Nobody's charged?
Correct, under the exception.
Under the exception, nobody's charged.
That's right.
And if the court doesn't go your way, nobody's charged.
That's right.
So technically, the concern that Justice Patterson raised does not affect the fund at all. It doesn't affect the employers, first or second, at all.
Correct.
All of this comes out of the fund, and the fund's calculation assessment against all employers throughout New Jersey might be affected in some immeasurable degree, but the first employer's contribution or the second employer's contribution, whether or not the work was started, would not be affected.
That's right, which supports, again, the narrow reading of this exception.
Why is that?
Because knowing that neither employer will be charged and the fund will not be able to recoup those benefits paid out, you need to have a limited pool of people that this applies to. And knowing that these folks are going to be reemployed and having that be the verifiable evidence that they're reemployed at least gives some confidence that they're entering the workforce again.
That's only true if they work 8 weeks. Not true if they work one day.
Under this exception, it would. If they work one day, if you read the legislative history and if you read the transcript of that Senate hearing, what Senator Madden was really getting at and what the committee was getting at is it wanted to protect those individuals who left their job and then immediately were reemployed.
You really think he intended to throw under the bus people who fall in this category? The people who have their jobs rescinded one day before they're going to begin to work?
They're not being thrown under the bus, Justice.
And what about this language from our court, that the statute's remedial purpose is, now I quote, to provide some income for the worker earning nothing because he is out of work through no fault or act of his own. Right? That's the remedial purpose.
It is.
So have they done anything that is attributable to them? They do anything wrong, these workers?
They quit their job.
They quit on a promise of employment. So are you claiming that there is fault on their part? Because
To a certain extent.
Tell me how. Tell
There's
me how they're
fault on their part because again, quitting your job never entitles you to benefits. Never. It's a two-part analysis. You have disqualification and then requalification.
Well, you can't say never.
Isn't your argument contrary to the goal of having people leave for better jobs and be protected?
Doesn't the
interpretation you find directly in the face of that?
Absolutely, it's not. It doesn't fly in the face of that. What it does, because again, you're talking about a two-step process here. Someone quits their job, they're disqualified. Everyone agrees that at that moment, when they leave their job, at that time and place, if they were to apply for benefits that day, they would not qualify. They can only re-qualify for benefits if they are re-employed and work 8 weeks.
That's if we accept your argument.
But taking aside getting to the exception, just let me walk you through it.
No, I think you've done this for us a few times. You're talking about the opening lines of the statute. We understand that. The question is, what's the breadth of the exception which liberalizes the
statute?
But
why that makes sense is because you have to read the two together. It's limiting. Madden indicates that it's in the hearing that this statute is meant to relieve certain individuals from the burdens of requalifying. And it's those individuals that are reemployed within 7 days.
It's also meant to encourage people to leave for better jobs. That's what the exception is about. And if we read the exception the way you want it read, that encouragement is gone. It flies in the face of that.
It's not gone at all. It just requires that they actually commence that employment.
We understand your position. Is there anything you wanted to add before we get you back for rebuttal?
I think I will reserve for my rebuttal.
Good. Mr. Lesser, and I'm going to invite all the able counsel on this side to hear one another's arguments and feel free to incorporate rather than just repeat them.
Good morning, Justices. I believe a lot of what I intended to cover has been covered in the colloquy regarding the policy intention of the law. This law was not a narrow exception to a condition. It was a liberalizing amendment that was intended to take people who were unfairly out of work because they accepted a job, they relied on that job to their detriment, and they were unemployed through no fault of their own. The McCain panel reads that following language, which does not commence more than 7 days, as modifying the acceptance so that at the point where they accept, they know that there's a job to start 7 days. And this really, the 7 day requirement really only makes sense. It doesn't make sense as a reemployment requirement. It makes sense as avoiding someone wanting to take a vacation and taking a lot of time off. And it's also a token of how firm that offer is and would facilitate establishing that date. it's not the narrow exception that they put it out to be. There are really four conditions here that we would get to for, I divided into four, for qualifying for the protection of this law. And none of them is actual commencement. One of them is you have to accept a job that has better or equal hours, that must commence within 7 days of leaving the other job, and you voluntarily quit. Okay, and there has to be a voluntary quit for this to accrue. I don't see really the need to beat this a lot more. I think you've mentioned it infinitely in your considerations and what it is. The much has been made about looking to the legislative history, which we're not supposed to do if we think this is unambiguous. I don't think this is necessarily unambiguous. I think there are plain readings and plainer readings. You know, I think there's a plausible reading for why our adversaries have found as they did. I think that flies in the face of the policy goals and doesn't do justice to the law and doesn't modify the right part of the sentence. But obviously, there's disagreement on that. But particularly, they point to the idea of it being laid off, and they suggest that they were trying to ensure that someone was reemployed quickly thereafter. Well, they, you know, that finding can be made at the point where the job is accepted. It does not have to be made. It does not require the actual commencement. The goal of that 7-day period to avoid someone taking a vacation or to make sure it's a firm offer is met if it's a 7-day offer and the client, the claimant recipient detrimentally relies on it and finds themselves unemployed involuntarily through no fault of their own.
Let's just assume for a moment that it is that we would look at legislative history, mm-hmm. find the statute ambiguous. Do you dispute your adversary's contention that what was on the minds as expressed of Senator Madden, who was the sponsor, and the other members who spoke at the hearing was the layoff situation?
I do not dispute that they were focused on that situation. I do claim, however, that they simply didn't consider the other, and that, as I have argued here, and even the Blake court admits, logically, these people, whether they commence or don't commence, are in the same position. They're both unemployed through no fault of their own.
When we look at legislative history, we often see in the sponsor statement, for example, the bill is to do X. Sometimes they simply restate the language of the bill, but sometimes there are statements in there that give us a real articulation of the policy objectives of the statute. If we, for simplicity, if all we see is this is about problem A, and it appears that problem B is maybe a subset of problem A, but wasn't actually talked about. Do we assume that only A is the focus, or do we loop in B on a sort of a general policy argument that if they wanted to address A, they must have meant to include B?
I think it depends on the strength of the connection between the subset, mm-hmm. logically, and the thing that they were narrowly focused on. And here I think it's very strong. I think it's identical. And so it would depend on the situation. And in this situation, those two are equal.
Your adversary talked about problems of proof. Now, in a perfect world, you have written letters. But sometimes employers, even if they write a written offer, don't rescind it for reasons, strategic reasons, in writing. And there may, in fact, be situations where there is no proof other than the recollection of an oral conversation, which may or may not be verified by the employer, may actually be denied by the employer. If an employee, I understand, I'm not getting away from your case, if an employee comes forward and says, I had two phone calls, one they said, start on February 1st, and here are your wages and hours, here's your hourly, and here are the hours you're going to work, and then another one in which they said, we can't do that, our other employees coming back. And that's all they have. Does that employee meet the burden?
I think it really depends on the judgment of the fact finder in that condition. And also, whether or not the fact finder thinks it's necessary to add a documentation requirement to it in order to establish the case.
Let me ask you, is it from your experience in handling these matters, is there a way to find out? Is there a way to contact that second employer and find out if this is true or not?
In fact, if I had such a case, I would ask them to contact the second employer mm-hmm. and get something in writing. There's always a way to contact that second employer.
If the employer says, respond, we don't want to get involved, you know, I'm just trying to get at how sure. difficult is the proof problem here. If the employer says, we don't want to get involved with this, we're busy, could you, as counsel for such a claimant, use some kind of legal process, a subpoena or some other process to really compel them to state the truth?
We can request subpoenas.
Request leave to file a subpoena?
We can request
subpoenas
when it's at the appeal tribunal level or beyond.
Okay. Thank you.
Other questions? Anything you'd like to add?
No. I'd like to
thank you.
See my colleague.
Coleman.
Thank you. Thank you, Justices. I don't believe it's necessary for me to rehash everything that's been said before, but there's one or two points I'd just like to point out. I believe Justice Ravner had asked opposing counsel if the Blake decision, the fact that they apparently got the chargeability issue wrong, that they whether or not that in any way undercuts the decision. And I believe counsel and the board's position is that was only dicta in the Blake decision. I believe that if there's a close reading of the Blake case, it really is not dicta. Dicta is something that's not necessary for the ultimate finding, but underlying the Blake panel's analysis of both the legislative history as well as the issue of the proof problem, underlying that was the mistaken belief that the real prejudice would be to the first employer because of the chargeability issue. In terms of the legislative history, the Blake panel cited correctly that the first employer would not be charged. And I believe the amicus will discuss this in more detail. Apparently underlying the Blake panel's decision was a mistaken belief that some employer had to be charged. And if the legislature had declared in the legislative statement by this the Senate sponsor that they specifically stated that the first employer would not be charged, the Blake panel apparently believed that if the employee actually commenced work and even worked for one day, that somehow the second employer would be charged. And I think through the discussion here today, I think it's pretty much established that whether the employee is works for one day after after leaving, you know, one day at the job, or the job is rescinded one day before, the practical effect and as well as the legal effect would be exactly the same. The first employer, neither second employer would be charged. So practically speaking, and legally speaking, there is no practical difference between the rescission within the 7 days or an employee being laid off shortly after commencing the employment. As also in terms of the legislative history, I think the McLean panel pointed out in its decision that the sponsor statement isn't itself conclusive. In the beginning part, in one part of the sponsor statement, there is a term layoff that's used, but in a second later part, the sponsor statement specifically says that, quote, treating other work as good cause for leaving work without indicating that there was any necessary commencement of work also was the underlying purpose of the amendment. So because there is ambiguity, two panels of the appellate division analyzed this, analyzed the plain language,
came out with diametrically opposed interpretations. Our position is that, I think Mr. Lesso had said, that either reading could be plausible. Then the question is, if the legislative history is not dispositive either, then I think that it's proper for the court to construe the amendment within the overall remedial purpose of both the statute itself as well as the remedial purpose of this amendment. If the amendment was to limit, benefits, not to expand benefits, then maybe if it's an exception, maybe a narrow reading would be appropriate. But because the legislature was responding to a perceived need to expand benefits in situations where people are trying to better themselves through better job opportunities, if and given the fact that there's ambiguity in the language and the legislative history may not be dispositive, then the overall remedial purposes should control in the court's interpretation.
I think we heard from Ms. Schaefer that this is this should be construed. She didn't say necessarily narrowly, but it should be construed carefully because it is an exemption from an exclusion.
Yes, and I think the interpretation that the Blake panel accepted does have enough protections that there would not be abuse. So in other words, if an employee just happened to leave for any reason, for a personal reason unrelated to a new job, and then they just happen to find a new job within 7 days, they would not come within the protection of this amendment because they were not specifically leaving their job to seek other employment.
Just a parenthesis, it's not raised by your case, but does an employee have to identify when they leave that they are leaving for another job to their employer?
I don't know if they actually have to, if that's an actual element or a condition of the actual statute. I don't believe reading the statute it requires actually giving notice to the employer. I think that they actually have to, though, be leaving for that reason. And obviously that may be a proof problem at the time of a hearing.
You're saying that they may not have to say so, but that has to be the case in order
yes.
to that from the exception.
Yes, and at the time of the hearing, if there's going to be a contested unemployment hearing, it would be incumbent upon the claimant to provide proof as to the reasons why they left, that it wasn't for any other reason other than accepting a better job, and that the time frames would have to be consistent with the statute. I think I'll stop there unless there's any questions.
Would you know how common is this rescission within 7 days situation?
If you asked me before these cases, I would say maybe not too common, but the fact that our office happened to have two cases simultaneously and that these cases were decided by the appellate division within 1 month, I would say that it's probably not that often, but maybe not that infrequent. And actually, although it's an unreported decision, but it was discussed in the amicus brief, that the Chando decision actually puts another slant on the scenario, where in that case, the employee was scheduled to start the new job within 7 days, but the employer pushed back the start date, I think a week or two, and then the employee actually worked 1 day and then was laid off. So there's different permutations of this, but the key is that at the time of the acceptance, that there's an expectation that the job must start within 7 days of leaving the new employment. And I think that allays any fears that the board may have as far as this being open-ended or being some type of after-the-fact justification for someone leaving their job to try to come within this amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Goldman.
All right, thank you.
Sure. rest assured your argument got a little easier in that the board doesn't disagree with the thrust of your brief. What would you like to tell us?
Well, I have three brief points I'd like to make, Honorable Justices. With regard to the legislative intent, and I was in the room, and Senator Madden, you don't really rarely get this, said, I wrote the bill, and it was my legislative intent to make sure that people like this that are in this situation don't slip through the cracks. We in the business called it the black hole, the situation where a person who left their job for good cause, for a better job, to better themselves, was disqualified even though they had done nothing to disqualify themselves. It was a hole in the law. And this is what Senator Madden and the legislature sought to fix. The object was to protect and not to prevent eligibility for unemployment. With regard to the Blake case, this was really a very unusual circumstance. I've handled thousands of unemployment matters and have never had a situation before. When we went to the Senate committee hearing, we had never had such a situation where the job had been rescinded before there was even a day. We had had many situations, however, where people began to work and have anywhere between a day and 8 weeks, they were terminated and they would then be disqualified for their benefits. This is a very unusual situation.
So just following up on Justice Timpone's question of your colleague, how big an issue is this in terms of how many claimants would be affected by the outcome of this appeal?
Oh, it would be almost infinitesimal in the scope of how many people apply for unemployment benefits. We have 40 to 50,000 a year applications in an average year. It goes up and down, and maybe this will happen two or three times where the job is rescinded. And with regard, and you'd raised the issue of policy, and I think it's a very important point to make here. The exception in this amendment proves the rule. When we brought to the committee's attention that here's a woman who gave notice and the employer immediately terminated her, she would be disqualified under the statute as written. The committee immediately took steps to fix that. And they said, well, if somebody gets fired because they give notice, and I had said to them, if you disqualify somebody from benefits because they had the courtesy to give their employer notice, employees' attorneys like me will tell them, don't give notice anymore, because if you give notice and you get fired, you're not going to get unemployment. And that is precisely what happened to Cynthia Blake and Patricia McLean. They had the courtesy to go to their employer and say, look, I just want you to know, I'm going to be leaving.
But they're not in that last section of the statute.
Well, but the last section of the statute, policy-wise, is intended to protect people who give notice and then lose their jobs. Remember, in both of these cases, if they had waited until their last day of employment and said, bye-bye, I'm out of here, which they have the right to do, they would still be working there because their jobs would have fallen through and the employer wouldn't have replaced them. In this case, both the reason that Cynthia Blake and Patricia McLean filed for unemployment benefits is because they had the common decency to give their employers notice, and their employers replaced them during the 2 weeks so that when that job fell through, they had no job to go back to. Clearly, and this is where I always say sometimes the exception proves the rule, the fact that the legislature immediately amended the statute when I brought up a situation where somebody who gives notice could end up not getting their unemployment because they gave notice, and this would be bad policy. They agreed, and they immediately changed it. I had never thought of a scenario that an employer might rescind before they would ever start employment.
Would you agree that the legislature just did not contemplate the scenario that is now before the court?
Oh, I can absolutely guarantee that because we were there. We talked about it.
Because you were the person in the room.
I was in the room.
Have you seen the musical Hamilton?
I was in the
room. Oh, don't start it.
I was in the room
don't
where
start
it happened. I almost quoted that in my brief.
Okay.
I didn't say it, so you wouldn't have made any impact on me. And don't plan on seeing it either, but I don't go to the movies either.
The musical Hamilton has the ability to substantially lengthen this oral argument.
Anything other than Hamilton that you'd like to touch on?
Thank you. With that, Your Honor, Neela, New Jersey, is very concerned that the unemployment paradigm that we have, it works. And it works because it protects people who are out of work through no fault of their own. This statute was not intended to punish Cynthia Blake and Patricia McLean. It was meant to hold them eligible. I have nothing further to add. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Schaefer, rebuttal?
Very briefly. So I'd like to just agree with Mr. Shore that the state is not arguing that this exception is meant to punish anyone. But, I will close with sort of just the general concept that when you're looking at when you're doing a plain language analysis and construing a statute, certainly you ascribe words their ordinary meaning, but you also have to read those words in the context with the related provisions of the statute to give sense to the legislation as a whole. And here, because this exception only modifies the standards for requalification for a limited group of claimants following a disqualifying event, it must be construed to require commencement of that subsequent employment.
As counsel for the board, do you take issue with the representation about the limited number of cases this fact scenario will present?
We have absolutely no way of predicting how many individuals would fall into this category. There's no data that I'm aware of that show how many folks would leave their jobs based upon an offer of employment that is rescinded prior to beginning that employment.
Since the amendment went into effect, have you seen a lot of these?
No. There has been, it's these two cases. The Shando case that was mentioned is separate facts. She actually commenced her job. It was just outside the 7 days.
Sounds like a very small number.
Yeah, I'm not aware of any other cases that have come through.
Thank you. And thank you to all counsel
for the helpful
arguments. We'll take the matter under advisement. Court's in recess. And